Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hello, listeners, and welcome back. Another fantastic day here in Yorkshire and another fantastic guest to the podcast. Now, if you've been listening recently, I think I probably said this on a few introductions, you will have noticed an adjustment in direction from me, thinking and talking more about being a high-performance human rather than just a high-performance athlete. And as we all know, you can't really be a high-performance athlete unless you are a high-performance human. So I'm delighted today to introduce onto the podcast a gentleman. I've known of him and we've spoken in the past, but this is the first time we've really got chance to chat in depth. So firstly, Colin Rose, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. Pleased to be on it.
Anybody who gets a chance to watch this video will not believe me when I tell them that you are actually going to set a record today to be the oldest guest we've had on the podcast.
Okay. Right. I'm 80 years old, which is one of my qualifications, I think.
Well, it's certainly the qualification for being the oldest. I actually think that the two of the next oldest were Dr. Paul Clayton, who you know very well, who we had on a few weeks ago to talk about health extension and something that will cross over quite a lot with today's conversation. And also another friend of mine who might fit into that mold of being a high performance human, but also into your, he might fit into your book that we're going to talk about delaying aging. He's an Ironman world champion. He's 74 now, and he's already preparing for the 75 to 79 category. So got that enthusiasm for life. And he won that race in Hawaii at the age of 72. So that was Simon Butterworth. So, but you've surpassed them by a number of years. So,
Well, okay, the other qualifications is I'm not on any medication whatsoever. To be honest, that makes me quite unusual in my age group.
Certainly does. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. So I first was introduced to you by a mutual friend of ours, Toby Baxendale, in connection with your Univite Healthcare. So I guess for full disclosure, we ought to talk a little bit about that and your your business there, because a lot of the stuff that you write about probably would point back towards Univite. So we ought to talk about that. So just describe a little bit about what makes Univite different in terms of supply of supplements compared to what the companies that most people are aware of.
Right. Well, one of the misconceptions I think that people have is they think about supplements, right? And you immediately think of vitamins and minerals. And yes, of course, we know there are 23 essential vitamins and minerals. But that's really half the story, because if you look at all the data, taking a vitamin and mineral supplement by itself has some effect. Obviously, you're going to prevent being deficient, but that's not really the criteria. The criteria is whether you have the optimum level of nutrition to counteract, you know, the forces. In this case, we're talking about aging, counteract the forces, drivers of aging. And so the other key elements are the plant nutrients. And to talk just vitamins and minerals as supplements is, as I say, half the story. You really want to get into the other things that are health protective, like the I don't want to use lots of terms today, but the polyphenols, the micronutrients. I mean, in the same way, they're micronutrients. And curiously enough, just this Sunday, the Sunday Times had a big front page article actually about Imperial College, who were they were using artificial intelligence to look at literally the whole database medical database to see what are the actual, and they actually used the term hypernutrients.
Was this the article where they talked about how you can download an app and they were using the power of hundreds of thousands of mobile phones while people were asleep to number crunch, and that gives them more power than half a dozen sort of 1970s NASA computers, doesn't it?
That's the one, and I've joined that too. And I think anybody listening would want to join that. Doesn't cost you anything.
I did look at that. It wasn't immediately apparent within that article what the name of the app was. Can you let people know if they want to join that?
I can if I look it up. At the end of the. I've got the article here.
We can put it in the show notes anyway. But I saw that and thought, oh, I'm going to join this because if we, you know, there's another little thing that we can all do to help, and the benefit that, and the data that they accumulate out of that will go way beyond fighting COVID, won't it?
Yes, it will. Absolutely. And you know, I've had. I don't want to go too far down the route of our own company because. Which I will talk about, but because the book we're going to talk about doesn't even mention our products or our company, because I was anxious to keep that as, you know, as sort of objective as possible, if you like. But yes, vitamins and minerals are less than half the story, really.
I mean, as I was reading the book and reading your thoughts on the various minerals, turmeric, curcumin, you know, CoQ10, yep. All of those things.
Yep.
I did, you know, understanding what is contained in your supplement packs. Yeah. I did see some correlations there, but as you say, if I hadn't known that, then I wouldn't have been any the wiser that was an associated business of yours.
Yes. Well, okay, fine. Well, let's deal with that now, and then we go on to the bigger subject in a way. What you're trying to do, I think, I mean, no supplement is ever going to or should even pretend to substitute for a good diet, okay? So what we did originally, and I did it with one of your podcast guys, Dr. Paul Clayton, who was then at the Royal Society of Medicine, what we're trying to do is to reproduce kind of the best of the best. You know, we all know the Mediterranean diet is, you know, plenty of studies say that's ideal. There's also many of the places, Okinawa, for example, that people live long and healthily. I'm not just into life extension, but more health extension. There are places called blue zones around the world, which you may have dealt with in a previous podcast, where people live again to ripe old ages, into the literally 90s and 100s, you know, without any medication or healthily. And what we really did, kind of in a way, but, you know, less impressively than the Imperial College, we looked at all those and said, how could you add the nutrients with the biggest bang for the buck, with the biggest impact on health? And yes, there are things like CoQ10 and grapeseed extract and green tea extract and omega-3 fish oils, etc. It's a kind of like, it doesn't substitute in any way. You've still got activity is still important. Eating properly is still important. But to get to the level which has been identified by Imperial College and American Cancer Society of 10 portions of fruit and veg a day. That's the level at which it's protective. Mm. And incidentally, the government, you know, knew when they came up with a 5 a day, everybody knew it wasn't 5, it was nearly 10. And they just literally, I know this because I know somebody in the committee, they sat around and said, well, nobody's going to do that. So what do you think we get away with, 5?
What I will say, Colin, is that the listeners of this podcast, because they're into their high performance, may have a better chance, but still most of them will be challenged even by reaching the minimum threshold of 5 a day, which I've said many times is, look, don't be thinking this is your target, this is your starter. Yeah. We had a recent guest on who was talking about gut health and the microbiome, which is another thing that you talk about in your book, and which is an area of huge untapped potential, I think, for human health in many areas, and which there's a great deal of work going on right now. She talked about diversity and variety in your food stuff. So don't just limit yourself to the same vegetables every day. Try different ones. And then she said, actually, if you can consume 40 different vegetables or fruits or nuts within a week, that should be your target. So I opened my fridge full of vegetables thinking I was going to easily achieve that and got to 32. So
well, that's impressive in itself. But you're right, that diversity. I mean, you're right. I have a chapter in the book Delay Aging on the microbiome. And the standout conclusion is its diversity of foods, because that creates the condition in the gut, which what you're really trying to do with the microbiome, the good microbes are trying to outnumber literally the potentially harmful ones. But that's what it's all about, and variety trumps all. They did interesting studies in Italy and Japan and all over, and the sheer variety in your gut is the key to it all.
Let's look back a little bit then, Colin. You started Unifyte in what, early 90s, was it?
No. It was 86.
Okay. So before then, I know you say in your book and in some of your writings that you are a writer first and foremost. So how, and I know you had another business of accelerated learning systems, which has nothing at all really to do with health or aging or vitamins and minerals and supplements. So I'm interested in how you got into this subject and what's turned you almost into an expert on this sort of whole process of aging, which is coming to all of us.
Yeah, you can't avoid the passing of the years. There is a connection there. I set up accelerated learning. I basically sold a business in 1984, I sold a business, and I'm not saying, you know, had enough money for the rest of my life, but I, you know, I had no pressure. And I decided, well, what do I do next, right? And I got very intrigued in how people learn. And can you basically help people become better learners? Because that seemed to be a fundamental skill, right? You can learn, particularly in science, you can do a science degree, and it's probably going to be outdated in 4 or 5 years' time. So the underlying skill that makes people successful is the ability to learn quickly, learn effectively. And I did a lot of research on that at Oxford University. Didn't join Oxford University. I just basically, you know, joined a department and used the libraries, really. And I wrote a book called Accelerated Learning, which was all about this. You know, how can you be a more effective learner? We self-published it, which is the Accelerated Learning Company. And to my absolute astonishment, we sold, not immediately, but over, you know, through 2 or 3 years, we sold 500,000 copies around the world. And Bantam Books in America took it up, and it was, I think, 16, 18 languages. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. People are really interested in this. And then from there, I set up languages. I thought, how do you prove this works? Okay. I thought, well, the one thing that I could prove is, like, if you know no German today, and in, you know, 5 months' time, you can speak German or whatever it is, Spanish, whatever. I kind of proved this works. So I did that. That then led to, or has led, and we now have language, 20 language schools in Poland, for example, doing that. But the driving idea is, stealing one of your phrases, how do you be a better person, a better human, a more developed person? So that was the one side. It was mind, if you like. And then the other logical thing to do is body. You know, so there's the connection. And originally, I thought about body at the time. This is now 1986. There was a lot of interest in weight control. Mm-hmm. And I came up with the idea, as I tell you, it's absolutely true, as one does, reading the New England Journal of Medicine one night, as we all do, right? And I suddenly thought, well, that's true. They were treating patients with literally sort of vitamins and minerals, the minimum amount of carbohydrate, adequate protein every day, some fats, and it all came to about 500 calories. Right? And well, I'm thinking, can you live on 500 calories a day, you know, for a period? So we did a test, let's say, clinical trial would be an exaggeration, but, you know, a test on 50 people at University of Surrey, came up with something we called in the micro diet. And it was, I've said myself, it was a big success. It was a really big success. Because, you know, it's true. You, for a short period, you can live on that level. I wouldn't recommend it, you know, for very long, but we proved it was healthy and people lost the weight, etc. And that got me into nutrition generally. We no longer do it. I sold it to a company in Japan, in 2012. And, but I got interested in nutrition. What do nutrients do and how does the body work? And it goes back, I have to say, to my parents. One of the points people ask me is, you know, what really motivated you? Mm-hmm. And my mum died extremely suddenly in her middle 50s, actually. Within 4 months, my healthy dad had died too. Wow. And he died of cancer, absolutely inoperable cancer. Of course, I can't go back all those years now. But because I was 27 then, but because the sheer shock, you know, immune system crashed. He had no defenses against anything. And it all came together, you know, like, how do you stay healthy? How do you prevent these sorts of things happening? You can't, you know, traumatic situations you can't prevent necessarily, but you can strengthen yourself. So that's the kind of genesis, if you like, why I got interested.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you talk about the micro diet there, because I've read this before and you refer to it in your book about the research by Walter Longo, of the fasting 2 to 4 days. And that became a little challenging for people to do. So he introduced the 900 calories a day for 5 days, I think, to see what would happen. And I've read a bit about him, and certainly a guy, a Dr. Peter Attia, who does a podcast based in California, and he's, done a lot on the keto diet, but he's also a cancer doctor, isn't he? And so he talks about the benefits of fasting prior to chemotherapy and how that can help you deal with the chemotherapy. So there's you know, these things keep coming around in little circles, don't they? And you keep thinking, well, if they keep cropping up and there are significant credible researchers finding this evidence, then there must be something to it. It's not just a one-off that's a bit of a phony.
No. Well, intermittent fasting, I mean, if you... if you want to know, you know, the keys to healthy longevity, it isn't necessary. Well, intermittent fasting has become very popular in California. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this, I looked at the research on this, and yes, particularly on animal models, if you restrict calories to animals, they live longer. There's absolutely no question about that. But then, to be fair, you're talking nematode worms and you're talking rats and mice, and so it doesn't necessarily translate to humans. What I think is inarguable is that calorie reduction, a reasonable amount of calorie reduction, is one of the factors in healthy aging. And I don't mean starving yourself, because, you know, it's self-defeating. You know, in the last song with that, and being hungry. But I use it in the book, there is a very, from the blue zones, you know, these we mentioned, of where people stay healthy into their 90s and stuff. One of the things, they do have less calories a day. And there is a wonderful phrase called hara hachibu, Japanese phrase, hara hachibu, which is eating till you're 90% full. Now, I said to my wife, hey, I, you know, I was writing the book, gosh, I think this is really, really interesting. And she quite reasonably said, yeah, but how on earth would you know whether you're 90% full? Right? And it's that thing of conscious eating, of eating, stopping, you know, during the eating process long enough to say, am I full? That's 100%. Or am I satisfied? Am I you know, happy now? And that's the 90%.
So one of my other roles is as a nutrition coach, not a nutritionist, but a nutrition coach. So we're looking at ways in which we can overcome the obstacles that people have to eating better. So a lot of it's about planning and preparation. When it comes to weight loss, and my qualification was through a Canadian company run by Professor John Berardi, and it's called Precision Nutrition.
Oh, yeah.
And
very good.
One of the, I think they say that for 90% of people, the two most successful strategies to losing weight are to eat slowly. So
mindful,
have no distractions, no TV watching, no, just sort of putting food into your mouth, you know, almost like on a conveyor belt. Take a moment to that whole thing that your mum used to tell you about chewing your food 30 times, you know.
Well, yeah.
But there's probably a little bit in there about enjoying the textures. And again, going back to your comment about diversity, if you've got different fruits and vegetables that have got different textures, some crunchy, some soft, different tastes, then by enjoying the mouthful of food, you can get that whole experience. And that's what the top chefs are trying to create, is the eating experience, isn't it?
Yes.
So you get that, you perhaps put your knife and fork down in between each mouthful, you maybe take a sip of a glass of water. And the second skill, I would say that most of the people that were in my nutrition program got hold of the eating slowly very quickly. But the one they found the most challenging was that exactly what you've described, eating until you're 80% full.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused now. I think your book refers to 80% full, 90% full, but
well, so, I went 90 in the end because I think you're right. It was 80% full. But if you did do that, then it's easy not to restrict calories. It's easy to just somewhat less calories. Mm-hmm. And somewhat less calories leads to something which is very important, which is insulin sensitivity. We may talk about that later on. You know, less insulin in your body, insulin drives inflammation. That's really one of the absolute key drivers of all the age-related diseases and aging itself. So lowering your insulin levels, which is, of course, your insulin is in response to eating. So reducing insulin is one of the key factors in healthy aging. And you can, when I say easily, you can easily do it without restricting yourself in any major way by just doing what you're talking about. You know, mindful, slower eating, and eating till you're satisfied rather than full.
Well, the thing is as well, it doesn't have to be super precise, doesn't it? It doesn't matter whether it's 80% full or 82% full, and you can't really measure it. The point is, and I think the point is that you need to stop at some point before you feel like you're stuffed. I mean, we're in a week's time, or, you know, from when we record this podcast, we're all going to be sitting down having Christmas lunch. And traditionally, we just eat until the plate's gone and we get up feeling like we're just about to burst. So if you know what that feels like, that's eating until you're full and you couldn't fit, you know, like the old Monty Python sketch with Mr. Creosote. Do you remember him when he couldn't fit another morsel in my mouth. That's right. Not even the wafer thin mint. So just dial back from that a little bit. It's just an experiment to see what can happen. Now, people from, even from my era, Colin, but certainly from your era that were brought up in the years after the Second World War when we had rationing, will tell me that their parents said to them, don't leave anything on your plate, you shouldn't waste food. And I understand that because that's what my parents and grandparents said.
Yeah.
But there's an easy solution, is just to put food on a smaller plate.
Absolutely right.
Right? Yes. And leave some of it in the pan. And then when you finish what's on your plate, maybe take a pause for 10 minutes and sit and think, okay, just I'll sit and chat, I'll have a glass of water. Because we know that there are receptors in the stomach, the ghrelin receptors, that kick in after about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing a TV program where they did some research where they got people to eat a burger and they just let them eat it. And after 5 minutes, it was all gone, and they all wanted another one. Then the next day, they said, right, here's the same, a similar meal, but you have to take 30 minutes. So you have to make sure that you still got some food on your plate when the bell goes in 30 minutes time. Yeah. They were all full. So with the same meal, they were all feeling full because the only difference was the time that they took to eat the meal. So it's those little receptors. So by having a smaller plate and just giving yourself time, you give the receptors in your stomach a chance to get to
work. Well, I tell you something, because we've all experienced lockdown this year, 2020, and our local pub, you know, and we want to support them because I live in a village that's it. There's one pub, nothing else. And of course they do takeaways. Really interesting. So we ordered, we want to support them, we ordered takeaway. It came, and I'm looking at this, and my wife's looking at this, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is what we normally get if we eat in the pub. You know, Simon, we halved it, we had half each. It was absolutely enough. It was absolutely enough, much to the disgust of the publican, of course, because we're ordering less. But that was a real eye-opener to me, just how much we accept as normal. Yes. And we just, you know, one portion does two meals.
Well, and you know, because I hang around with a lot of triathletes who do a lot of exercise and consume a lot of calories to fuel that and recover.
Yeah.
And so they have big appetites. And so if you go into it, my brother used to run a restaurant and told me that there was actually a scientifically derived formula for how much food you put on a plate. Because if for the average person, if they leave it, they feel like they've been ripped off. They've been overserved and overcharged. And so you want to give them something that just leaves them feeling full. But of course, when I'd go there, I'd finish all of this and think, well, where's the rest of it? So part of it's training as well, isn't it? And our and what we've become accustomed to.
It is. I mean, your precision nutrition, I think, is an absolutely excellent program. And you'll know from that is the protein element on there is about a pack of cards, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's.
I think they're using a palm size, but
but it's same sort of thing, really.
Yeah. We've dived into some of the subjects, so we touched on them, so that's a good introduction, Colin. Let's just go back a little bit then. When you were growing up, you talked sadly about your mum and dad passing away very quickly and a young age, really. Did you have any solid role models that you can remember that inspired you to pursue this sort of you know, delayed aging type thing? Do you remember people that you looked up to and thought, wow, they don't look their age, you know, they're still running, they're still doing all these things and they're in the 60s?
I'd have to be honest, not at the time. To me, the big thing was my parents dying and why did they die, and really, was that necessary? So it wasn't something, but well, having said that, and as you know, the first few sentences in the book is that people accept that you get older, you get weaker, you're not able to do as many things, etc. It's a kind of inbuilt. We anticipate that. We accept that. And I got interested enough to write the book, Delay Aging, because that's my everyday job. I write on health generally. And I got interested in an article that was called The Hallmarks of Aging, which wasn't very long ago. And one of the guys involved won a Nobel Prize for identifying what are the drivers behind aging. Now, I'm not going to go all through. There was essentially nine. They've added the microbiome now. Microbiome out of whack is the 10th. Which I put in the book, but I won't go through them all, but there are some key elements in there. And one is, and I referred to that, is aging is damage. It isn't the years, it's the damage you accumulate during that years. And some of that's totally inevitable. I mean, you know, talk about damage to the mitochondria. Well, you know, the act of living, you're going to be incurring free radical damage to your mitochondria, because that's burning oxygen, you know, and that's metabolizing food. That's all creates, you know, a level of free radicals. It's the excess free radicals you want to damp down. So it's damaged. And one of the key things for people to understand is, you know, you would die at 20 if you hadn't mechanisms to replace that damage, to renew, you know, to repair that damage. You know, that's happening all the time. That damage is happening all the time to DNA, to mitochondria, to cells, but the repair mechanisms kick in. But come your 40s, basically, after that, these repair mechanisms begin to weaken. And the big question when I was doing the book was, how do you maintain that repair mechanism? You know, because some of the damage you can avoid, you know, the sort of thing you talk about, exercise, you know, continuous daily exercise or continuing with daily exercise. Yes, that's important. And, you know, a good diet, fruits, vegetables, etc., the obvious things, they're good. How do you repair that? How do you keep that repair mechanism going at full blast? And that's what it's all about. And there are certain key things I think you do that. One is, I'm going to use a term, you know, technical term here, autophagy. You know, you will have read that. You would be personally familiar. Some people aren't. Autophagy is basically when cells die, and you have 50 billion die a day, right? Most of them, of course, are cleared away by your immune system, etc. A few will hang around, which they call senescent cells. They're kind of zombie cells, they're called. A few will hang around. Those cells, the debris, pours out, you know, toxins, which cause inflammation, which in turn is sort of chain reaction, which in turn damages cells, damages DNA, etc. So encouraging that autophagy, which means self-eating, clearing away damaged cells, is one of the keys.
Yeah, my understanding of autophagy is from when I've read about fasting. And one of the benefits of fasting is it encourages autophagy, it encourages the clearance of those cells. So I know a lot of people have now jumped onto the fact that, you know, when you fast, obviously it's super restrictive on calories, and so therefore you lose weight. And of course, that's the big headline that always makes the news, isn't it? Yeah, new fantastic way of guaranteeing weight loss. But that's actually the benefits to health, because you will slowly gain that weight back again, I think, for most people.
Yeah.
Particularly if you do your fasting the wrong way, you'll end up gorging on food and it all goes back on. But the benefits are of the clearance of those zombie cells, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Yes, that's what it is. You do that with calorie restriction, which, as I say, doesn't have to be necessarily, you know, really shocking calorie restriction. I think some people, intermittent fasting does work. A lot of people won't engage with that, which is hence the 80% call strategy. Frankly, cold shower. No, there are things called heat shock proteins.
Yep.
And, you know, exposure to temperature differences. That's important. Your expertise, exercise, that encourages autophagy.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the cold showers. That's one of my little things that I do every day, just a couple of minutes. I've been experimenting with that. A friend of mine recently got into cold water swimming, which is growing in popularity. And the biggest thing for him, he says, is his mental health. It's about meeting. He meets with a group of people. They all go in the sea, he's a fireman as well. So he finds the safe places for them to be in the water. And they go in and they swim around for 5 or 6 minutes. But he says, do you know what, Si? I just can't stop eating. I've lost loads of weight. I mean, he's a lean guy anyway, but he said, I feel exhausted from being in the water for 10 minutes because I'm shaking for an hour and a half. You think about all the exercise and movement that your body's doing by shivering for an hour and a half. But, I mean, mental health is probably going to crop up in our conversation later. It's been a huge part of delaying aging, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's the key sentence, I think, in this whole conversation is that the drivers of aging are the same as the drivers, very believably, as same as the drivers of of age-related disease, right? So if you stop one, and there is a famous quote from somebody at Imperial College in London, one of the researchers, QVC, David James, or Professor David James, at Imperial College, if you delay aging, you delay or you avoid, you know, all the diseases that are associated with getting older, you know, including Alzheimer's, including cancer, including heart disease, because the underlying drivers are the same. They're all the same.
I think that's what you've touched on there a couple of times now, is this idea that what happens to us as we get older isn't inevitable. It's within our power to control it. You know, you see statistics now that I think it's gone from 1 in 3 to 1 in 2 people will be affected by cancer at some time in their life. You know, it might be as minor as a small melanoma on your arm or on the back of your hand from too much sun exposure to, you know, that sort of the really terrible stuff that requires months of chemotherapy and radiotherapy and maybe some operative processes. And I think also people just think, well, it's inevitable then, you know, I'm probably going to get cancer and there's nothing I can do. But that's absolute nonsense, in the same way that aging, yes, we are all getting older chronologically. You know, we all celebrate a birthday. We all celebrate another Christmas. But equally, we know people who belie their years and are still doing things that we didn't think physically possible. Now, medical developments have allowed a lot of those people to live a lot longer. You mentioned right at the very beginning about not being proud of the fact that you're not on any medication. That will be one of my ambitions as well as I get into my, you know, my 60s and 70s, not to be taking any medications. That they offered to give me statins because they said they thought I had some calcification in one of my heart arteries, and I've refused that because I feel like I can control this situation through my own interventions. It's within our control, but it requires hard work, doesn't it? And so for those people who are listening that perhaps aren't at our age yet, and you've still got a few years on me, but I'm probably at the upper end. but the point is that you can't just start. If you start when you're in your 60s with better habits, that's fine. But why not start when you're in your 30s or 40s, laying down the foundations for healthy living into old age, because once they become habitual, then you just do them naturally. And it doesn't feel like hard work if it's part of your natural daily process.
Yes. And it's positively enjoyable. I mean, you mentioned, I can't claim to be, a regular wild swimmer. First of all, I live as far away from the sea as you could possibly do in the UK. But both my grown-up son and daughter, they go, to a lake close by. I can't claim to do that. But you're right. You've got to ideally start these healthy habits young. Now, of course, I want to be really clear, because one of the dangers is, people blame themselves, for example, to get cancer. I think if you're talking to heart disease, strokes, diabetes, etc., these are acknowledged to be maybe 90%, maybe more, lifestyle driven. Right? They are avoidable. There are a few people with genes that predispose them to heart disease, but it's a very small percentage. Cancer, we ought to say that, Simon. There is an element of sheer luck involved. There's sheer bad luck involved. But it's still only maybe 10-15%. That's all. And people talk about genes. Well, you can't change your genes, but you can change the way genes are expressed. That's one of the things that I really would want to highlight, or do highlight in the book. You've got things like oncogenes, which cancer genes you want to turn off. You've got genes, protective genes you want to turn on. And it's astonishing how powerfully you can do that. You know, yes, you can't change your genes, but the way they are expressed, you can definitely change.
So that's what you call epigenetics, isn't it? It's genetics.
Yes.
And sometimes we talk about this with athletes, of nature versus nurture.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's a big, you talk about the microbiome, that's big, you know, the amount of research in that now is colossal. Same with epigenetics. I mean, there is huge, huge research. Same again, which we touched on. The scientists are now, nutritional scientists are now really down to the micro level, identify what are the nutrients. And we know plants, you know, fruit, veg, we know that's important, right? And there are macronutrients in those, you know, fiber being the key one, which are important. But there's also micronutrients there. And we're beginning to understand which they are, which are they actually used. I wouldn't have dared use the word hypernutrients because I think it's too much of a sort of a consumer, you know, media headline phrase. But they use that in Imperial College. You know, they use that phrase. There are nutrients which really, really have a big bang for the buck.
Yeah, in the same way that people call now, we've got this whole thing about superfoods, haven't we?
Yes.
You know, and I'm a nutritionist that I was once listening to was somebody was once asking him, you know, should I be steaming my spinach or boiling it? And he said, how much spinach do you eat now? And he said, not much. He went, well, just eat spinach. Yes. It's, you know, it's a superfood regardless of how you cook it. Just eat spinach. But let's get into the weeds on this, Colin, because one of the things I'd really like to do is for listeners to have some sort of idea of some of the strategies they can put in place. I think probably, judging by what we've talked about so far, we'll be covering some of the areas that I've covered in previous podcasts. So this will be repeating some of those good messages. And hopefully, the more often we repeat them from listening and speaking with experts like yourself, the more people will believe that actually these have a fair amount of traction. I'm just looking in your book, chapter 12 nicely summarizes the previous 11 chapters. And you referred to the hallmarks of aging, which had been sort of that whole phrase and title have been coined by somebody else. So you cover, I'll just run through those now and we'll talk about some of the things that happen. So you talk about cells become senescent. So basically they're sort of dormant. They're not really doing anything. They're just lying there and they need to be cleared out.
Well, they are doing, yes, they're not doing anything positive, but they're doing something really negative. They're putting toxins here.
So I always think about when they talk about free radicals, it always reminds me of the Lothario at the party. He's single and he's going around chatting up everybody else's wife and encouraging them to have a dance with him and a little kiss in the corner and basically disrupting the homeostasis. There's all these other couples in the room and then there's this one guy in there. And he's going around trying to disturb the balance. And then, of course, when he steals somebody's partner, you've got another one that's left on his own. So he continues that. And you know, it's just the way my mind works. But
well, it's a lovely visual. But you're right. It's a chain reaction. Free radicals is a chain reaction. Mm. The answer to that chain reaction is you have antioxidants. Free radicals are oxidization. You know, of fats and glucose, actually. Mm. And you need the antioxidants to stop that chain reaction going on. Like vitamin E is one, for example, and there's lots of plant nutrients.
One thing that we find in triathlon and probably other endurance sports is that a lot of people who exercise and train for events like to be in this zone where they're training kind of hard. We have, I don't know how familiar you are with physiology, but you have an aerobic threshold, which is where you start to see the slight increase in lactic acid. And then you have anaerobic threshold where you see a big increase in. And so there's really three zones. There's below the aerobic threshold, above the anaerobic threshold, and there's the bit in the middle called the threshold, which certain scientists, some of whom I've chatted with on the podcast, talk about being the black hole or the dead zone or the, you know, where you don't go. Because you never really working really easy. You can work quite easily and develop develop those mitochondria and improve mitochondrial density, or you can work really hard and polish the mitochondria so they become more efficient. The training in the middle, which again a lot of these scientists are saying we should perhaps only spend targeted time there rather than all the time, creates oxidative stress. Now oxidative stress is what you're talking about here in terms of those free radical developments and creation and
yes,
that then whilst you may feel like it's improving your fitness, it will have some other negative connotations when overdone.
Yes, when that's the key, when overdone. So, you know, you need to be in the right zone, don't you? And it's well known that that some athletes who are over-exercising, their immune system reduces. You know, it's really quite a significant issue. So, yes, it's a balance. And I think if I had to characterize our discussion today, which I'm enjoying, it's all about balance, you know. Yeah. And even the word supernutrients or superfoods, I'm slightly doubtful whether that we really should use that, because there's so many foods, the balance between them all. But, yeah, certain foods do more than others. There's no question about
that. Yeah. And, of course, you can eat superfoods all you like, but if that's 50% of your calorie intake and the other 50% is the opposite, it's takeaways, then you'd more than just balancing it out, you're completely undoing all the good work you've done. You know, you'd be better off not eating the superfoods, but just getting rid of the rubbish.
Yes, you are.
Let's go back to some of those other hallmarks of aging then, Colin. Damage to DNA. I mean, I'm looking at cells become senescent and damage to DNA, and the counter to those is exercise or movement and calorie restriction.
Yes.
We talk about mitochondria. Now, for athletes, mitochondria are important. They're the energy production cells. They're like our little factories.
Yes.
If they become dysfunctional, it's probably another reason why we start to lose our athletic prowess as we get older, if we're just not as efficient. So, that low level, in my mind, that low level exercise we do where we can stay healthy, we don't compromise our immune system, and we can keep producing mitochondria is absolutely critical.
Yes, that's right. And there are certain nutrients that we know do affect the mitochondria directly. CoQ10 is one, you know, the limited food sources of that. But, you know, believe it or not, sardines on toast is... We just said we wouldn't use the word superfoods, but sardines on toast is you don't have to necessarily eat expensively. I mean, if you look at the role of CoQ10, yes, sardines on toast. Sardines are good, give you that. Beans on toast, you know, really good for you. There's loads of fiber in beans on toast, loads of good stuff. So it doesn't all have to be expensive, but you do need to know what the ideal food plan is.
Yeah.
And one of the things I quite surprised myself in a way doing this, having researched, you know, nutrition and health for 30 odd years. So I ended up in the book with a food plan, which was, you know, of course it was heavy on fruits and veg. There's quite a lot of plant protein in there. As you get older, the evidence is you need a bit more protein. I would recommend you make it more. The extra protein is plant protein. I certainly eat. I'm not a vegan or even a vegetarian. I'm a reducitarian. You know, I have reduced my animal protein. I can see why people don't want anything to die for you to continue to live, but. You know, the evidence that I found when I was doing the research is there is nothing wrong with some animal protein, but you restrict it, and you certainly restrict the, you know, red meats, etc. You definitely restrict those.
Yeah, there's a strong movement now based on the back of a book by the name of the doctor I can't recall, who's written about the carnivore diet. I think one of the arguments he has is that. For those of us who do still eat meat, is we've moved more towards the prime cuts and we don't eat nose to tail. Whereas historically people would eat, you know, they would eat nose to tail. And, you know, if you're having a chicken, then eat the skin and eat the fat and then boil the bones down and make some stock for your next soup or something. Bone broth has got some very good health benefits to consuming that on a regular basis. You make mention of collagen in your book there, and of course bone broth would be a good way to get a regular supply of collagen. I think also the quality of the proteins that you're eating, it's something we talk about in Precision Nutrition, is the quality of the foodstuffs you're choosing. Yeah. So if you're going to eat meat, you know, maybe, and again, I don't know how many times I've brought this up in a podcast now, but it's something that my friends are fond of making fun of me about when I ask whether the beef has been grass-fed or corn-fed. Mm-hmm. And they don't think there's anything significant, but there's a huge significance in the way that those animals have been reared. Yes. So it's if you are going to choose meat and you don't have an ethical issue, and I'm perfectly comfortable with, I've got friends who are vegetarians and vegans, you know, it's a choice. But if you don't have those ethical issues, then at the very least, make sure that the way the food is reared is good quality. And that would also go for the vegetables that you're eating, and trying to eat organic where possible and avoiding the pesticides.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's something which you will have read yourself, not just in the book, but called The Dirty Dozen.
Yes.
Which is not a film with the I can't remember who was in it now, but anyway,
it's Hank,
not
Marvin, no, Lee Marvin probably. Lee was Marvin. One of them, and good stuff. Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, great, good film. But The Dirty Dozen in this case is the fruits and vegetables which have the most pesticides on them. Those mm-hmm. are the ones to avoid. So if you're going to eat organically, and I do think that's right, there's research at the University of Sheffield showing that eating organically is equivalent of eating at least one extra portion of fruit and veg a day in terms of the amount of nutrients benefits you get from them, anti-inflammatory, antioxidants. But if you're going to do that, and it's more expensive, at least go for the ones on the Dirty Dozen to eat them organically. Some of the others, it's fine. Oh, and one other thing which I really want to emphasize is the importance of color.
Yes.
It's the importance of color. And people have said to me, well, you know, why is it what is it in fruits and vegetables that is so protective? Well, here's something a lot of people don't recognize. When plants develop and grow, you know, they don't grow these nutrients for our benefit, these anti-inflammatory, antioxidant nutrients for our benefit. They are protective against heat damage, sun damage, insect damage, etc. And the most protective elements are largely in the skin and in the colors which are in the skin. So very often, if you want the hyper nutrients that Imperial College use, they're in the colors, you know. And that's why things like lycopene in tomatoes, for example, is a really important nutrient. Lutein is important. Beta carotene, the orange color in carrots, etc., and other vegetables. And very often in processed foods, you know, again, another theme, why are nutritionists so much against too many processed foods? Because they throw away one of the key elements. Most of those processed foods throw away the skins and the colors. And so if you really want these hypernutrients, if you like, they're in the colors and the skins. And that's why in the final wrap-up of the ideal sort of food plan, I did it, color-coded it. You know, you need these colors on your plate all the time.
Yeah, that comes back to our whole diversity variety thing, doesn't it?
Yes.
And in fact, I think I made reference to the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 in the previous podcast I did, when we talked about gut health. Bella Linderman mentioned that then, and that Clean 15 and Dirty Dozen changes from country to country, doesn't it? And
it does.
What was interesting there was I posted that somewhere and asked people to have a think about it, and a couple of people posted straight away, oh yes, I can see that it's done by some woo-woo charity, you know, they're bound to be picking on things like this. And I'm like, well, just have an open mind and look at it in a bit more detail, and just maybe be, again, I think we'll probably loop back to this phrase, be more mindful when you're choosing what foods. Think about, if you're eating pineapples in the United Kingdom in the middle of winter, you need to think about all sorts of things. How long have they been stored for? Where were they grown? How were they grown? How much, and you know, how damaging was it to transport them to the UK?
Nutrient loss, yeah.
You know, and something I talked about in the podcast with Paul Clayton was the mid-Victorians, you know, that he wrote those three papers about the way they lived their life. And he talked about eating locally.
Yes.
And eating seasonally. And again, looping back to another podcast link, a gynecologist who I spoke with last week from America was talking about how she'd had all sorts of health problems, IBS, thyroid issues, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things she talked about, because she didn't use medication to correct all of her problems. She used better, cleaner living and you know, stress management. But she also talked about eating locally.
Yes.
Eating seasonally. Again, something that perhaps we might be forced into with Brexit. It might not be a bad thing if we can't yeah. ship stuff in from Spain yeah. in the middle of winter.
Well, and also eating, you mentioned, touched on that, eating for your microbiome, you know, making sure you've got good levels across a week, not every day, you know, of things like onions and garlic and leeks and stuff, which ferment in your gut, and that fermentation creates something called butyrate acid. And that's really important because you think about this, in order for your food to create, or your gut to create the nutrients that go through the gut wall into your bloodstream, that's what has to happen, right? You need, visualize it, tiny, tiny holes in that gut lining in order for the nutrients to go through, but they're going to be really, really small. And one of the key things, like in IBS, which is an increasing problem, it's an inflammatory disease, is you get bigger holes, if you like, in the gut wall, which lets slightly undigested particles of food, tiny, tiny again, but, you know, through, and that triggers inflammation, which goes then back to things like people a rise in the degree of the number of people who are gluten sensitive. Now, I think only about research says about 7% of people are gluten intolerant or insensitive. So, you know, majority are not. But you have to be a bit aware that gluten can be a factor.
What you're referring to there, Colin, is leaky gut, I think. Little holes. And again, that's something that's been spoken about on a couple of podcasts. Talking of gluten intolerance, we came up with a great analogy last week of we've all got friends who we love dearly and we get on great with them when we meet them for dinner occasionally or we have coffee with them. But if those friends came around to live in your house and they left their rubbish everywhere and they didn't clean up after dinner and their room was never made, you know, and they just occupied your internet and took over your TV, we'd grow intolerant of them because we've just had too much of them. And it's the same. It just because you're intolerant to something doesn't mean you can't ever eat your favorite bread. It perhaps just means that you need to eat it more sparingly rather than every meal.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And and there's one thing I don't want to miss, because I know you interviewed Dr. Paul Clayton as well, who's a great friend of mine and fabulous. He's so knowledgeable. The other thing that going back to is this: are we talking about health extension or life extension? Really key point there. If you extend health, you're going to extend your life somewhat, you know, inevitably, and that's good. I'm certainly way off, you know, some of the researchers are talking about living to 150. I think that would be a disaster for the planet, a disaster. Mm-hmm. And I also think it probably would be a personal disaster. But that's a more philosophical point. What we're trying to do is extend health. And one of the statistics that is shocking is, yes, we've extended life extension. You know, the average is 81 for women, 79 for men, roughly, in this country. But the last 10 years of most people's life is led with some form of disability. And to be honest, if you said to me, why did you write this book, or why are you doing what you do, is because I know that's not necessary. you know, I know that's not necessary. It is possible to sort of live healthily and kind of fall off your perch in the, you know, in your 90s, as it were. And that's expensive. You know, my mother-in-law, you know, went to a care home. I mean, eye-wateringly expensive. I mean, eye-wateringly expensive, you know. Why would you risk that when relatively small changes in your lifestyle, you know, across these four domains of nutrition and activity and meditation, which we haven't touched on yet, etc. Why would you do that? You can cut the risk of that enormously.
I'd like to loop back just to these hallmarks of aging, Colin, if you don't mind. We'll sure. briefly cover them, and then to wrap up this program, let's talk about some of the strategies that we can start to employ relatively easily. And, you know, for most of my listeners, which will have profound benefits for your health, but also then because of that on your athletic performance.
Yeah.
So we covered mitochondria. I think we talked briefly about epigenetics, which is the sort of nurture bit, having to do some hard work to correct things rather than relying on nature to take its course. So our beneficial genes, which fight cancer and which help with the fight against disease, switched off.
Yeah.
And the harmful ones are switched on. So again, exercise and activity is the priority there with those, as well as changes to nutrition and some of those things. Interestingly, when you were talking about fermentation and eating onions and leeks and that sort of stuff, you were talking about prebiotics really there, weren't you? Not probiotics, but prebiotics. And they're generally not as easily available in a little carton that comes in the yogurt section of the supermarket. They're really just food. So things like sauerkraut and kombucha is another one. And some of those things are very, very useful there.
Yes, absolutely. So fermented food, that includes, you know, some of the Japanese foods. That's important because, I mean, we actually sell a probiotic. So I'm for probiotics because I think one of the things you've got to do is you've got to, let me touch briefly on probiotics because there's an absolutely booming market. People are interested in it. You need a good probiotic, in my opinion, anyway, it's got to have, you know, at least 8-9 strains in it, because different strains colonize in different parts of the gut and do different things, right? Different for your health. You need a reasonable amount. So, you know, 12 billion is the one in our probiotic. Sounds a lot. It isn't. I mean, you have trillions of microbes in you, but what you need is a probiotic that colonizes. You know, that's the thing. No probiotic you're going to buy, including the one that we do, is going to do it on its own. It has to colonize and multiply, you know, and gradually crowd out the bad ones. That's the way they work. But these probiotics alive, they need their own foods, and that's what you're talking about, the prebiotics, which you get from fermented foods.
Yeah.
That's key, and that's all down for food.
Yeah. Finishing off then, telomeres. That's quite an interesting one. We talk about telomeres in strength training, but my understanding is obviously you're talking about here in terms of aging, but if once the telomeres start to shorten, you lose strength and that's sort of a vicious circle really, isn't it?
I'm not an expert, on telomeres, obviously, but the way I look at telomeres, they are, if you like, there's no question, that, you know, known to be, they are a kind of a sign of aging. The shorter your telomeres, the less time you have to go, as it were. You know, when the telomeres completely kind of run out, that cell's dead. I think they're more a marker. I mean, yes, I do sort of look in the book at one or two ways that you can increase your telomeres. But I think that's more a marker of everything else you're doing. In other words, if you do everything else we've been talking about and engage in the sort of food plan that we've hinted at today, then you are going to, your telomeres aren't going to be, they're going to be stay longer. And there's a Nobel Prize winner has basically confirmed that. It's more a marker of everything else that you're doing.
Yeah, some other things then. Stem cells become exhausted.
Yeah.
Again, we can reduce that through exercise and calorie restriction and changing our nutrition a little bit. Interesting, polyphenols, berry polyphenols keep cropping up there. I know that there's often this debate about whether red wine is good for you or not, but great polyphenols, I think, have been associated with some of these longevity processes. So as long as you don't go mad on drinking a bottle a night, it's probably okay to indulge in a small glass of your favorite red at regular intervals. Oh,
I looked at it. I really did spend quite a bit of time because I happen to like red wine.
Me too.
And yes, it's not a glass, a couple of glasses if you're a man, is not a problem. Unfortunately for both of us, the amount of red wine you'd have to drink to get enough polyphenols is staggering. I mean, a Majestic wine would probably, you'd need to be down there. but you can go, interesting, because it's all, this polyphenol called resveratrol is the big one. Resveratrol is important, but it's not very bioavailable. You'd need to drink an awful lot of red wine to get enough of that. And you get it in peanuts, for example, in various other foods. Again, the theme today has been range, hasn't it? It's been a wide range. It's been balance. And if you were to ask me, and not just because I'm talking to you as an expert trainer, personal trainer, physical trainer, I'd probably put, well, let's assume that your diet's pretty good. Let's assume you're getting at least these five a day, five a day. I would put exercise close to number one, activity, staying active, but I mean, that doesn't mean that you've got to be down pumping iron all the time. Just staying active. Maintaining a good weight. There's so much evidence that that slight reductions in weight or maintaining a normal weight, that reduces insulin sensitivity, which is a key driver of aging. What I call the modified Mediterranean diet. So, like, because we, there are other societies like, Japan, for example, and Asia. Where they have quite a lot of soy. So modifying the Mediterranean diet, adding some of these nutrients, these polyphenols, because I think even that isn't going to get you to the level of protection which you need as you get older, keeping these repair mechanisms going. So adding some of these polyphenols, which you get in green tea extract, in grapeseed extract, which, by the way, has resveratrol in it. And then things we haven't touched on, which were part of lifestyle, relaxation exercises, maybe meditation session once a week. It's all that round balance.
It did get me thinking, because I've seen links to the Mediterranean diet and the Mediterranean lifestyle, and then the links to longevity. And it did occur to me then when we were talking about that, what else those communities do to extend their life. Sure, of course, it's not been a deliberate sort of policy to set out to extend their life. They've just lived that life, and that's what it's happened. So that's how research happens, isn't it? We see something happening and we want to go and explore why it's happening. Yeah. They seem to have quite close family units. So not sort of like we tend to now do in a lot of the north and northern parts of Europe and the Western world is sort of like, these nuclear families where everybody's separated. So you're quite cohesive family units. They don't discard the elderly to homes. They sort of still keep them involved. And so that because you're part of that community, that keeps you active and you may be involved in looking after grandchildren, playing with them. And of course you can't do that if you're in a incapacitated. they probably take, we're fond of making fun of the French and the Italians and the Spanish for having long lunches, but maybe that's the secret, is to, instead of rush everything, is to take your time and go back to that thing about eating slowly and enjoying your food rather than seeing it as an interruption to a busy life. Maybe those communities also are less connected to electronics and perhaps more connected to nature. So Paul Clayton talks about the Victorians working in the fields, the navvies digging the canals into their 50s and 60s and doing workloads that, quite frankly, 10 of us would find difficult for one day, and that was their everyday existence.
Yes.
So there's a lot more to it, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
And we talk about the two nervous systems, sympathetic and parasympathetic. So sympathetic, people will know, is fight or flight. And for most people in the UK, I would say that they are in a constant state of fight or flight. They're rushing from this task to that job, to that chore. In between that, they're trying to answer phone messages, text messages, keep up with the news, navigate, you know, high levels of traffic, all of which are creating stress hormones.
Yes.
And we also, because you know, and I lump some of your entrepreneurial friends in here, Colin, feel guilty if they're sitting down with time to spare. And yet that's the time when we allow the parasympathetic nervous system to kick in, the rest and digest.
Yes.
And the bit when we switch off, when we do those things that you talk about, yoga, yes, meditation, breathing exercises, just idly gazing out over nature and enjoying watching the birds float on the air currents, or watching the, you know, the boats on the ocean, or whatever you choose to watch.
Yeah.
But not, I think actually it was in the book I mentioned called Go Wild, where they talk about meditation isn't about disconnecting and emptying your mind. It's actually being very, very aware of what's going on around you and being entirely connected to that.
Yes.
Not distracted.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that phrase, a reason to get up in the morning, you know, you're right that, you know, the blue zones. And I actually end the book with that phrase. I would like to be a mini blue zone all my own. Well, not literally, not all my own, you know, with the community. And only last night we were talking to my grown-up daughter. She's 26. She's still at home because the younger generation have been hit hard, haven't they? Very, very hard with COVID and everything else. All the, you know, the problems with employment. She works as a chef, but I mean, she's, you know, she can't afford her own place yet. We were saying, actually, you know, that's not such a bad thing. If I go to the societies, and I used to go to Eastern Europe quite a lot for a particular reason, I mean, that was common. They'd all be together. You know, you'd go to a dance and the youngsters were there and the granny was there and everything else. And we've lost that. And one of the bits of research, as you probably know, Sam, that people who are involved with the church tend to live longer. Well, I don't think that's necessarily, I may be wrong, but not necessarily the spiritual side of it. It's because they're a part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a shared sense of mission, and which is what these blue zones did. You know, they don't have to artificially exercise because it's part of their everyday life. They walk.
Yeah, for those people who've gone a little cold about the idea of suggesting we go to church, as you say, it doesn't matter whether your church is the gym or the running club or the golf club or anything else. It's the community and being an active part of that community, yes, that's the important, yes, point, isn't, yes, it, really?
Absolutely, yes.
And back to your comment there about there's no need to go to the gym because I'm active anyway. Again, you know, I can remember back to my grandfather used to work in a forge. He did enough manual labor every day to make him a very, very strong man. And I used to think that he was somewhat strange because in the morning he would stand out in the garden in his bare feet with his trousers on and his braces on and his vest with his eyes closed. And he would do these breathing exercises. And then he would get his Indian clubs out and he would do some exercise with those. And I'm like, what's, I'd been reading Muscle and Fitness and looking at all the bodybuilders lifting the dumbbells and on the machines. And there was my granddad doing this quite strange form of exercise. Then I found what looked like a cannonball with a handle on, and I later understood to be a kettlebell. Again, very popular, these training implements now, but back in the sort of late 70s and early 80s, things I hadn't seen. And this was my granddad keeping fit and doing his daily morning ritual before he then walked half a mile to work, and he would probably walk a couple of miles a day. And And then he would come home in the evening and tend his allotments, and they would eat their homegrown vegetables. And my grandma kept fit by doing the garden, doing the house, walking to the shops, and all the other stuff. There wasn't time to go to the gym, and there wasn't any need for it.
Yeah. Well, and interesting what you say about your granddad, you know, standing bare feet, footed. Mm-hmm. Again, my grown-up son, but he's really into bare feet, going bare feet. And his theory, and I've seen the research, and there's a lot to it, is that you've got free radicals, and one of the ways to help literally sort of eliminate them from your body is to create that charge between the ground, you and the ground, and you do that with bare feet. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not an expert in that, and I've seen the paper that he gave me, but there's an interesting, how interesting your granddad used to, and so much we've spent years and years of research to get back to what basically people kind of intrinsically knew anyway.
Well, it's come up in a number of podcasts. I think Paul Clayton might have mentioned it, is that, you know, whatever your grandma told you about certain things, she was probably right. But yeah, we used to think it was an old wives' tale, if you like, because it came from an old wife. But actually, the research probably shows us that they were onto something. And we've sort of because we now think that we're smarter than everybody else, we think we've moved on, but we haven't, have we? We keep getting confirmation of lifestyle methods, nutrition. I think
that's right. And look at the you only got to look at photographs of the people in the 40s and 50s. Okay, style, they're all wearing hats, which is just that's fashion, but are they overweight? No. You know, and I grew up in the era of rationing, you know.
Restricted eating.
Yeah, but a lot of it was vegetables, not so much fruit, because, you know, you couldn't get those out of season, but loads of vegetables. I will also add that my gran used to think that, you know, fat on toast, you know, the sort of fat you get beef dripping. So, oh yes, that's really good for you. It wasn't necessarily all true, but there was an intrinsic understanding that it was about keeping active. And
but there's something interesting there, though, isn't there, about animal fats, is that whilst they could be considered to be trans fats, they're still very close to the original source. So it's not like they've been industrially processed. No. So if you were going to consume trans fats of that order, that would probably be better than industrially produced vegetable oil that's been used in deep fat fryer a dozen times.
100%. Yeah, absolutely 100%. Yeah.
So in wrapping up then, Colin, it's been a fantastic conversation, by the way. I really, really appreciate you coming on. And we will signpost your book, because we've talked about some of the things there, but there's so many useful things in there that you know, everybody could, and it's really easy to read as well. So there's a lot of stuff that people could easily pick up. The strategies, I think, some of the key lessons, balance.
Yep. Yes, balance. The food plan in there, I think, is, I like to think it's the best of the best, because if you look at, we all talked about the Mediterranean diet, but equally, of the three best research diets, there's one called the MIND diet, which the research is, it reduces the levels of potential risk of Alzheimer's by at least 56%, I think it was. So I took, you know, the best research diets, the MIND diet, the Mediterranean diet, another one, which to my absolute shame, I'm just trying to remember. But anyway, it was kind of all the three best research diets. It is sort of like the best of the best. If you then add these super nutrients or hypernutrients for Imperial College.
I've got the diet here. There's the DASH diet, the MIND diet, and the Mediterranean diet. Yeah.
Thank you very much. For shame on me for getting it.
Well, I had to refer to your book.
Okay.
So those three diets
are the best, and I try to I put them together. I combined the best of the best in there. Mm. Added some of the Japanese and the Asian foods. And then on top of that, and I will kind of almost finish by saying, yes, that's really good. But as you get older and you want to combat all the stresses that normal passing of time brings on you. Yes, I think you should add some of these extra nutrients, not to substitute in any way, but it just gives you extra level and range of the nutrients we absolutely know are key to optimizing health. And then if you add the sort of thing you do, Simon, you know, if you add activity, daily activity, not just aerobic, but anaerobic as well, strength training.
In response to what you're saying there, Colin, and referring back to balance, I would say, yes, aerobic exercise is great. Obviously, we know the benefits of that, but we do need the strength. We do need the balance. Actually, we need to put some balance training in there. We talk about older people that might have osteoporosis. We perhaps can't reverse that, but what we can do is stop them falling over. And if they don't fall over, then osteoporosis isn't a problem. So balance, coordination activities, so hand-eye coordination, just having functional strength is an overused term, but functional strength for aging is, can you lift things off the floor? Can you get up off out of a low chair? Can you get out of the bath? Can you climb the stairs? Can you descend the stairs? Can you turn a corner? Can you walk on an uneven surface? Are you able to lift things over your head without dropping them? Do you have the power to be able to lift and actually manage that?
Yeah,
you know, that's what we really mean with functional strength and mobility as well, you know, counteracting tight joints.
Well, two things. One is in our family, because, you know, I've got four children, two much older daughters, and then two in their, one in 20s and one's just 30. And we use the phrase banish sarcopenia. If they see me, you know, lifting stuff, gardening, you know, banish sarcopenia. And sarcopenia is basically what you've been talking about, you know, the loss of strength as you get on. And one of the things I have a Facebook page and everything else. And the one thing that got the most percentage involvement recently was that actually, you know, Simon, standing on one leg, the ability to stand on one leg, either with your eyes open or closed, which is that the latter being difficult, is one of the genuinely scientific ways of seeing how strong you are. Strong in the sense of resilient, in the sense of resilient against disease. And at that, I got so much, you know, engagement on that post.
And we've all got empty minutes in our day. I do the one leg standing when I'm brushing my teeth. So
yes.
two minutes, and my most of the electronic toothbrushes these days have 30-second warnings, so you can change where you're brushing your teeth. So you can, yes. You know, I do right leg standing, left leg standing. I do some of my yoga poses. 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at night. It doesn't need to be any more complicated than that, does it? And you're doing it while you're doing something else. The other thing you'd be doing is you're standing on 2 feet. So why not have some health benefits to it as well?
You know, of all the things we've said on this podcast, which I've enjoyed, by the way, I think that's almost one of the most important things we've said. Not the standing one leg per se, is how easy some of these key strategies are to put into your life without, you know, change anything dramatically, but they make a big difference. They all add up to a really big difference, you know, and cutting, you know, who wants to live the last 10 years of their life, you know, with some disability? I certainly don't. And I don't think it's necessary.
Well, I met a guy while I was traveling recently. He was a Canadian guy, an entrepreneur, probably similar to yourself and Toby and some of the other people that we both know, sold a couple of businesses. I'd have said he was in his mid-60s. He gave me his business card, and on the back it said, "The aim with life is to not die slowly, but to roar into the graveside on your motorbike, shouting, yee-haw, what a fantastic ride." Now, yeah. And I looked at that, I thought, well, how we'd been talking about that the night before. How coincidental was it that I should meet this guy that was full of life and had that as his motto? Because it pretty much encapsulates everything we've discussed today.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I want to be totally used up when I die is another good phrase. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, hopefully it's not going to happen to us in too near a future, Colin. So once again, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been fascinating, and I've enjoyed reading the book, and I'd highly recommend both this and Health Defense, which was one of your earlier books that you wrote in collaboration with Dr. Clayton.
That's brilliant.
You mentioned your Facebook, Colin. Where can you give us the
It's facebook.com/ delay aging.
Okay. If you have a YouTube site where you've got any videos, or do you do Instagram, or
I don't do Instagram.
Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. More sporadic than I should be, but it's Colin Rose 40. Twitter at Colin Rose 40.
Okay. Well, we'll make links to those. I've got so many links to put up here. If there's anything else that you think that we should make people aware of, please do let me know.
Okay, that's good.
Once again, thanks very much, and I look forward to the next book.
I look forward to writing it. I really enjoyed today, Simon, and it's I think we got over some important points for people that it isn't difficult, but you do have to do it. I mean, you can't just sort of succumb to aging. You have to take action against it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can't rely on other people to do it for you. You've got to do the manual labour, haven't you?
You do. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Colin Rose, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Pleasure to me, Simon. Really is.
Listeners, hopefully you enjoyed that as much as I did. As I say every week, we'll be back next week with another great guest. For now, I'm signing out, so enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye. Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.